Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello and welcome back to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Mihai Kovasser, and I'm back here behind the mic with no less than three co-hosts for this exciting episode. I've got with me Aaron Wang, Michael Robert Kaditz, and Tegan Marshall, here to have what I hope is a very interesting discussion on meta-ethics. The way I like to sort of kick this discussion off is with the idea that we often ask how we should act, but rarely stop to ask ourselves what those moral judgments really are. And that's what meta-ethics delves into. So normative ethics is what we talk about often, things like utilitarianism versus versus deontology versus any other theory, contractarianism. That's how we should act. But a completely separate question is, what are those moral claims or ethical judgments in the first place? Where can we find them and what are they in their nature? So that's what I want to talk about here today. There's three theories that I'm going to bring up here as a kind of introduction to the idea of meta-ethics. I would like, as much as possible, to pry into the lives of my co-hosts here and see what they really think on these issues. To begin, I'll just give a brief summary of each of these theories. And the three I want to talk about are realism, subjectivism, and relativism. Realism is the idea that there are objective moral claims or facts that exist in the world or in the universe independent of humanity or human minds. So some things are right or wrong regardless of whether or not the last person was wiped off the face of the earth. There would still be things that are right and things that are wrong. So a good example of this is the old question of there's a museum burning down and you have the option to go in there and save a piece of art that's about to burn with the museum. And the question is, so, you know, we say that we want to save that art because it's the right thing to do, because it has value of some kind. But the question is, would it have value if people were still here, if people weren't here to see that art? So realism would say yes. The theory of subjectivism, on the other hand, would say no, that the only moral rightness or wrongness, the only value that any of these claims or ideas have is the one that we attribute to them in our own minds. So there's a few different branches of subjectivism, but we might get into that a little bit later. But just to put it simply, there are no moral facts. It's dependent on us and what we feel or what we believe. And last but not least, relativism stands kind of in between. So if realism is like mathematics, where there are truths out there that 2 plus 2 will always be 4, regardless of whether there's a human being on the planet to, you know those facts that 2 plus 2 is 4, and, you know, subjectivism takes on something like the element of taste, just personal preference, relativism is kind of like language, where there are rules right now for language, but those can change over time. So they're not universally objective or true, but they're true in context. So those are the three theories that I want to talk about today, delve into it, and see where my co-hosts stand on this issue. So first and foremost, I'd like to open up the floor and just ask if anyone has a strong stance on any one of these theories, if they want to say something in defense of one of them, just to start the conversation going.
Sure, I got you, Mihai. There are things that are objectively true. And I think that I would identify as a realist in the sense that there has to be some, at least there's an innate human desire to have a common recognition of objective right and wrong structures. Otherwise, we would not create legal systems. If everything was rooted in subjectivity, I think it would be hard to find a mutual agreement to build upon a legal framework to then develop a society. And I can say more about that later on, but I would say that although we're seeing in culture, rightly or wrongly, I won't address that, a shift towards more, right, it's what it's what you feel is best. There still needs to be an overarching set of principles to guide that more personal exploration, I think.
When humans fight each other, when they're competitive and they're cruel to each other, one who believes in objective morality might say that some humans are acting immorally, that they ought not to be fighting or they ought not to be cruel to each other. What about when animals like chimpanzees? Chimpanzees are notorious for fighting each other and being competitive and sometimes being cruel to each other and being warlike in some of the same ways that people are with each other. Would it make sense to say that chimpanzees are violating objective rules of morality? How can that be that animals who aren't even moral agents, who don't even have the capability to think about what they should or shouldn't be doing, how can we say that they are acting immorally? Aren't they just acting instinctively? So we're running into trouble here because then we would have to say that instinct or evolutionary developments are in contradiction with objective morality, which doesn't make sense. So what I'm suggesting is that what drives behavior is instinct. Objective morality is sort of irrelevant.
For audience members that want to look a bit further into that, that's a famous objection, or objection made famous, I should say, by David Hume, amongst others, who made this claim that exactly, he didn't mention chimpanzees, I think he mentioned an oak tree, and how sometimes a seed dropped by a tree will grow into another tree that overtakes its parent and kills it, or takes up the space that the parent tree has for its roots in order to grow. And Hume asks, well, if there are objective rules to morality that one shouldn't kill their father, or one shouldn't harm their kin, so to speak, do we blame the tree for destroying its parent if that's just its natural course? So interesting objection there from Michael. The big question then, if we're going to lean into subjectivity, is how can we have moral debate in the first place if there are no objective moral facts to debate about? That becomes the question, right? Because if you're going to say that there are, that objective morality is irrelevant or non-existent, then why do we argue with each other about what is right and wrong in the first place? What value does that have more than us just saying, I think that this thing, I feel that this thing is wrong, or I feel badly about this thing happening, not that there is anything wrong with it per se.
Yeah, I think that this comes back to natural consequences. It's true that in nature we see examples of things that we see examples of things that non-human examples that go against our instincts for what behavior should look like in human situations. But in human situations, we view these in a way because we understand social consequences, natural social consequences. The importance of caring for the elderly in a society, for example. That's something that everyone can see the value of as a human being because they understand that eventually they themselves are going to be an elderly human being. And so by respecting and promoting that value as an example, everyone in society benefits from that. So there, I think that in human societies, we see these realistic examples of behavior that are just based off of what we would consider common sense or natural consequence. And that's, I guess, an argument for moral realism.
A naturalist argument, I should add, but a good one.
What's interesting is we can't really separate out completely meta-ethics from normative ethics in the sense that the latter, normative ethics, derives in some ways from meta-ethical theory. So let me give you an example. So referring back to the example I gave of chimpanzees, and it might apply to oak trees also, the distinction that's often made as a rebuttal to the claim I made is that there's something special and unique about humans, which is rationality. So whereas chimpanzees and oak trees don't have rationality and therefore are just acting instinctively, humans have something unique, which is rationality, and have the capability of using their rationality to rise above the merely instinctive behavior, and to create a better life or more civilized life, to create societies that other animal forms like chimpanzees don't have the capability of creating. And so if we accept that meta-ethical theory, then the normative ethical theory of social contract, the social contract theory is derived from the premise that humans have a special capability of rationality. Using that rationality, humans can rise above and beyond the state of nature, so the Hobbesian state of nature, the place of the war of all against all, you know, by this theory, it's that world that animals live in. Humans have the capability of rising beyond that by using their rationality and creating social contracts to create political societies which offer better, happier, healthier, more livable lives than merely existing in the state of nature driven by instinct, where there is no objective morality. There is no objective morality in the Hobbesian state of nature, but humans create morality through social contract.
Just because the meta-ethical theory and the normative ethical theory seem to have a common premise, I don't think is proof to me that one necessarily leads to the other. So what I want to clarify is I think there is quite a separation, a distinction between meta-ethics and normative ethics, where any normative ethical theory can match up to any meta-ethical theory, not perhaps as easily to some as to others, but I think it's possible. So just to say that, you know, the theory of social contract requires rationality, and the theory of, you know, subjectivism, for example, that we apply morality, it also needs rationality, doesn't mean that they're necessarily bound to each other. As a matter of fact, I happen to stand on the side of contractarianism personally, yes, but relativism when it comes to meta-ethical morality, which is this idea that relativists like me, we disagree on the framework that we're using to talk about morality and its nature. So it's not that I don't disagree that there is morality by which we should judge our actions, but rather I disagree that that morality is universal, that there in every situation there's a right answer to a moral question. As a relativist, I say that there are, in each circumstance, in each situation, there is a right answer. There is an optimal answer per each circumstance. And so, first of all, I want to make that distinction, that I think meta-ethics and normative ethics don't have to be as tightly bound as people claim sometimes. And second of all, that, as an example, social contract theory matches, I think, best to relativism, but as Mikey just brought up, could match to subjectivism too. And I think that's why it's important to ask these questions, because it tells us not only... it's not only important to know how we should act, but it's important to know where our moral judgments are coming from in the first place, because it defines how we have the entire conversation and the framework that we use to judge things by.
So, Mihai, there's a lot of things to unpack here. I want to take a step back and suggest that, to Michael's point and also to Mihai's point, rationality isn't enough. Rationality for our good old Aristotelian and Platonic friends required there to be speech involved, required there to be dialogue involved. That for Aristotle, it was truly the ability of human beings to utter intelligible speech that made those conversations of ethics and morals possible. And then to Mihai's point, I would say this. I think what you posit is interesting. However, for there to be an ideal or for there to be a good solution in every circumstance, the way we come to those solutions is based upon prior experiences, which in a very practical sense is still going to be shaped by some objective framework. So I guess my question is, and I guess I'm playing into natural law theory a little bit, that how do you come to those ideal decisions in every situation. Like, what informs those if there is an element of subjectivity? Because surely, to use an extreme example, say we take Kant's example of there being individuals who are searching for someone. And according to Kant, right, you're bound by your maxim to let them know where it is or where that person is. So how would the subjective person respond to that? I know there's a lot to unpack there, but I guess my core question is, what informs those decisions that you would then deem to be the appropriate response?
In order to answer that question from a relativist perspective, for example, you have to take what authors often call a two-level view, which looks something like this. So first of all, there are human problems that exist that we did not choose, right? So in that sense, there's already some subjectivity eliminated because a lot of us are facing similar problems that we didn't choose to face in life, quandaries where we have to answer the question of what to do. You can frame this, like Aaron was talking about, naturalistically a little bit and say that these are human problems, right? That these are problems specific to humans and not to all animals. And so in that sense, yes, perhaps it applies to all humans. But so there's a realism of questions, to phrase it that way. There are questions that exist out there independent of human beings, in the sense that if you at any point placed a human being on the earth, they would be faced with some problems and some questions of what to do, whether it's about defending offspring or helping the needy or, whether to take resources from a place or another, questions of what is the right and wrong thing. However, the answers to those questions aren't told to us by anything universal, anything that exists prior to us. So, taken to your point, the element of experience comes from the fact that we are faced with the same problems in the world, but the answers to those problems and the optimal way to act, this is where relativism comes in. There's more than one way to go about fixing these problems, and those ways are not always going to be the same. They're not preset for us. And so to answer the Kantian problem of, say, there's a group of people hunting someone down. They ask to hide in your basement, for example, without telling you why, and then those people come knocking at the door. Kant would say you have to not, you can't lie. You have to tell them that that person is in your basement, regardless of what they're going to do to them. Well, the relativist would say something like, this problem can be faced by more people, and this problem is real. But the answer to this particular question depends on the context. If they're planning to torture this person for no reason, it's just they've picked a target and they're hunting someone down to commit this crime, Kant would be horrified at the prospect of giving that person up, I think, even while he sticks to his theory. And so you have to be able to appeal to what people already believe, but the morality can still be critiqued based on the facts of the matter.
If you don't know the reason and they come hunting that person down, how do you gain the information that they are going to be tortured unnecessarily?
If you don't have that information, then all you can do is act on the facts you know. For example, these people seem angry and are carrying weapons, and the person being chased seemed extremely scared and whatever. So you can't possibly judge the situation perfectly if you don't have all the information, but the idea is, depending on the facts of each contextual matter, that's how you make those moral judgments, not based on any overarching universal principle. Because I could turn the question to you and ask, what is that principle? Where are the rules? Show me the rules. Why is this wrong all the time? Too cool.
But see, I'm not trying to harp on you, Mihai, but I'm trying to give honest real time reactions to this. You see, I understand, but all of this moral framework hinges upon a sense of historicity, dependence on history and those social expectations that we see things throughout history all the time that we look back on and we say, how could we have come to that conclusion? If we hold to a subjectivist view, you run into the same problem. Versus if you try to set up an objective structure, even a mutually agreed upon social contract structure, you are hopefully a little less likely to allow history to dictate your morality.
Yeah, so I think I wanted to delve into this a little bit deeper. So in your example, I think Kant could approach this in several ways. So one, you could think about this as where does the individual's duty lie? Does it lie toward the overall rules of society or towards authority figures? Or does the individual's duty lie to their own principles, to their own conscience? So if you take the perspective that the individual's duty is to their own conscience, then they should protect the individuals in their care. They should protect the lives of individuals in general. If you take the idea that an individual's highest duty is to obey the authorities and the rules of society, then you have a different set of actions. So I think we can still view this within a Kantian frame or a meta-ethical realist frame, but we have to choose essentially what the overall guiding principle is, whether that is the lives of individuals or whether that is essentially the guidance of society in absolute submission to authority.
So just to clarify, so I just make sure I understand you well and I get your point. You're saying that the problem for realists is not that the realist framework, the idea that there's objective truths out there, is untenable. It's that we just aren't very good at identifying where those real truths come from or where they're based. Like, if we can apply ourselves to finding the source of those rules, we'd be satisfied with a realist view. Something like that?
Yeah, I think it comes down to a different principles. That there are different principles, and that if everyone, essentially, if everyone, this is kind of the realist argument, is that if everyone abided by and agreed to the same principle, then, and that principle was the real principle, you know, we would have a perfect moral society.
So you're saying that we can, and like Kant, you're saying we might be able to find that principle or those principles through our rationality, right? Through logic. That's one option.
That is, that is, I think, what has been suggested in the past. And how far the limits apply to that, or how far the actual limits of that theory goes, is open to, I think, interpretation.
Yeah, I wanted to inject a little more complexity in the discussion, as though we need some more. And I want to claim here that moral realism is not coextensive with objectivity. And I'll give you an example. So first of all, though, I wanted to clarify that moral realism is a pretty strong assertion. It really, in its pure form, moral realism entails a claim that morality is as real as, say, a rock or as matter itself, that there are moral facts, just as there are facts about physics or particles or things like that in the world. There's also facts about morality, like mathematics, like somehow morality is encoded or embedded in the physical world. Although it may not be physical, it's let's say that it's somehow embedded in the external world, extrinsic to human beings, independent of human beings, and as you were saying, Mihai, prior to human beings, a priori. That's a pretty strong claim, and one can reject that claim but still be a moral objectivist. And let me give you an example of how that can be. So I think that, again, Hobbes, I would say he fits that bill. So Hobbes specifically states that in a state of nature, prior to the social contract, there is no morality. There it doesn't exist. And so that, I think, is a refutation right there of moral realism. But he proceeds to lay out a model for objective morality. So he says that no person, no rational human being, would want to live in such a state of nature. So any rational human being who Therefore, being rational, being a human being, would not want to live in such a state of war, of all against all, would necessarily be interested in creating a social contract, which would be a more livable place for human beings to be. And then Hobbes proceeds to lay out an objective standard for what that social contract would be. So things like not killing each other without cause, not causing suffering, behaving in a certain way that makes for a civilization. I think that's objective. I believe Hobbes would say that that's an objective model that he's laying out. And yet, at the same time, he's refuting that those rules that would derive from a social contract, from basically a convention of people who get together and say, in the absence of any objective morality, in the absence of any moral realism, in the absence of any moral facts prior to humans, since there are none, we are in danger here of living these horrible lives with no morality. Therefore, we better agree on what the moral rules are, and these will be our objective, not subjective, not relativistic, but objective rules that all people ought to live by. So I believe I've laid out an example, a very fundamental example in Western thought of a refutation of moral realism, but the adoption and the assertion of moral objectivity.
Interesting. Yeah, so as you say, and I should clarify to strengthen that point, that you can be a realist as long as you make the claim, though it is a strong claim, that there are facts out there, you know, embedded in the world, moral facts, for example, that are as true as mathematics. You can be a realist as long as you uphold the claim that there is one such fact out there. So, you know, as long as there is one fact that is out there that is real, that is a moral fact as true as any mathematical, you know, proposition, you are a realist. You can say that some things are subjective and some things are real, but as long as you make the claim that one thing is real, then you are a realist. And as you say, then, Michael, you can split that up and propose this objectivism where maybe there are no real facts as true as mathematics about morals in the world prior to human beings, but there can be reached an objective framework from our cooperation that comes from that.
Can you give me an example, Mihai, of what you or anyone might propose is one single moral fact, some moral principle that exists embedded in the world, independent of human experience or human belief or human consciousness, where is it? Where is it embedded, and what medium?
I will actually give our co-host a little bit of time to think here as I tell you that you are currently listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find archives of this episode and others on mixcloud.com/the Canadian Philosophy Show. And shortly we will be informing you folks in the audience about a change to that archive. But for now, all previous episodes, including this one, you'll be able to find on mixcloud.com. Now that I've given a bit of time for our co-host to think here, I would like to toss the torch and put that question out to the open floor, because personally, I don't think I can point you to any single realist moral fact. I simply don't believe that that's possible, that that's the case. However, maybe our co-host here might have an answer to that question, or a possible answer that we can examine.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this would be the right answer. But one example of this that I can think of off the top of my head is the example that C.S. Lewis gives in his book Mere Christianity, where he says that there is a law of human nature that we can all see. And his examples is fairness, is that you can see that human beings all over the world from childhood know what fairness is without being taught. So if you have two children and you treat one more favorably than the other child will demand to know a reason why. They will not accept that. There's this idea that everyone should be treated somewhat reasonably, somewhat fairly, and that we know what this difference is without being taught. Now, of course, there's like differentiation and variation there, but the idea that all societies need a concept of fairness or have a concept of fairness is, for some, considered a universal.
So...